I don't know much about this stuff.
Correct. Mr. Monk's still here.
Representative, Mr. Monks may be able to respond to that as well. Unfortunately, it looks like he just disappeared, but perhaps your office or council working together can try to ascertain that information from him if it's available.
I'll check with Ms. McFarland, Representative Petsky, and see what she says. She's informed me that this bill has seen a number of sessions and they have a lot of research to back it up.
Okay, it appears, Representative, on its face that the existing language now authorizes the superintendent or authorized representative to, quote, apprehend and hold the escapee and absentee, or authorize any police officer to do that. And the existing language doesn't have reasonable grounds language in it. So from that approach, I don't know how long this existing authority has been on the books or what its background is, but it would appear this is more definite in terms of criteria. It does specify a procedure which apparently is necessary so that this authority can be recognized in an extraterritorial context, as well as eliminating any confusion in state. Okay, any other questions for council before we leave this bill, 176? Okay, if not, Senator Yee has an interest in Senate Bill 418, and she's down in Ways and Means Committee. She's been notified on that bill. We have 226. On 226, no one signed up on that bill. Council, can you review that bill for us, please?
Yes. Under current law, a person under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board commits the crime of escape in the second degree if that person leaves the state without the authorization of the board. The law does not cover, however, a person who is given permission to leave the state and then fails to return as directed. Presently, little can be done to force the person to return. This bill would expand the scope of escape law so that an individual under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board who fails to return to the state as directed would be guilty of escape in the second degree. The bill would also expand extradition law so that a person who has been found guilty of a crime except for reason of insanity and who escapes or violates the terms of the person's release, probation, or parole would be subject to the extradition procedure. That's the nature of this bill.
Okay. Apparently came out of the Senate on April 3rd with 30 aye votes. I'm not sure if the PSRB felt they needed to come in and talk to us or not. Apparently not. But let's see if there are any questions that council should direct to them or anyone else from members at this time. Okay, if not, was there anyone here who wished to testify on Senate Bill 226? Okay, if not, we'll move on to Senate Bill 418, and we're very pleased to have Senator Yee with us. Welcome, Senator Yee.
Thank you.
Yes, council will be glad to take
this. Chairman Springer and members of the committee, I'm State Senator Mei Yi from District 19. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 418. I believe this law is redundant of other ORS sections and probably unconstitutional. And this is the bill so-called the Oregon Riot Act. And this bill will repeal the Oregon Riot Act. The present Riot Act requires action of both peace officers and of bystanders who are near an assembly of people. This antiquated law mandates that the peace officer go among persons unlawfully or riotously assembled and arrest them. The arresting officers may command the aid of persons present or within the county, and no person when so command shall fail to give such aid and if he does fail to do so, he shall be deemed one of the rioters. ORS Section 131.990 makes the failure to give aid and to the arresting officer a Class C felony. It should be noted that present law further makes the neglect of an officer to exercise the authority with which he is vested under the Riot Act a Class A misdemeanor. I think the mandatory nature of the duties on both the peace officers and the bystanders makes the statute undesirable, if not unconstitutional. In addition, the broad description of unlawfully or riotously assembled is constitutionally suspect. The Act has lain dormant on the books for years prior to its use in Linn County this past summer. In that situation, three persons were arrested for failure to assist an arresting officer. One of the persons was a journalist. The Linn County District Attorney dismissed the action against all three. I know of no other case where the Act has been used. The Riot Act is also redundant of existing law. ORS 166.015 defines the crime of riot and makes such a Class C felony. ORS 162.25 makes it a violation to unreasonably refuse or fail to assist a peace officer in effecting an authorized arrest or preventing another from committing a crime where the peace officer commands the person to assist. I believe the best laws are the ones which are narrowly defined on sound constitutional grounds, evenly enforced, and further the values of our society. I believe any benefit which is derived from the present Riot Act will be derived from the existing statutes, other existing statutes, and I believe we can best serve our state by repealing the Riot Act in full, and I hope you'll join the Senate in repealing this antiquated frontier law.
Well, as a co-sponsor, Senator Yee, I want to thank you for your excellent presentation. I'm glad to note apparently certainly your colleagues, substantial majority, supported your position. Are there any questions for Senator Yee? If not, thank you very much, Senator, for coming up and sharing your thoughts with us and taking time from Ways and Means. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. If you need me, call me again.
Okay. We'll do that. We know you've got a couple other bills we're going to see you on, too.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you, Senator. Was there anyone else who wished to testify? Mr. Fedenke?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have some prepared testimony that I gave to committee staff, and which I hope has been circulated. I'd like to, if I could, go through my written testimony quickly because I think the background of this case will be very interesting to the committee. We have been working closely with Senator Yee on this bill and Hasso Herring, who is the editor of the Albany Democrat Herald. We have been seeking the repeal of this statute as a result of a case in Linn County in which we became involved last year. For the record, I should state, I forgot, I'm David Fedenke, Associate Director, ACLU of Oregon. A group of environmentalists calling themselves the Cathedral Forest Action Group began a series of civil disobedience demonstrations in the Willamette National Forest last spring. They objected to a timber sale in the Middle Sandy Am roadless area, which the group believed should have been preserved as wilderness. After the trees had already been felled, the protesters periodically set up human blockades on a nearby Forest Service road to stop the exit of log trucks from the area. These demonstrations, all of them peaceful, went on for a number of weeks. On each occasion, log trucks would be blocked until the Linn County Sheriff's deputies could arrive at the scene to place the blockaders under arrest for disorderly conduct. ORS 166.025 sub E, which is a Class B misdemeanor. Should be noted that at each of these blockades, only a small number of demonstrators would block the road and be arrested. Others were lawfully and constitutionally assembled by the side of the road, making their political views known and providing moral support to those few who had decided to commit civil disobedience. On July 17th, sheriff deputies reportedly told demonstrators they would not make any arrests until news reporters had left the scene. After a crew from KZI TV did leave because they were close to their deadline, the deputies dragged the blockaders by their hair and beards to a waiting bus. However, a freelance photographer, who had previously been a demonstrator on other occasions, took pictures of the incident and sold them to the Eugene Register Guard and the Corvallis Gazette-Times. A few days later, that same photographer took his photos to the Linn County Sheriff and filed a formal protest alleging police brutality. 1 week later, on July 23rd, the protesters were back in the forest. Only four people were blocking the road, but another 20 were standing by to provide support. Also present were some Forest Service employees, some representatives of Willamette Industries, which was operating the timber sale, and a few log truck drivers. The sheriff's deputy in charge approached the bystanders and called by name the freelance photographer who had taken the pictures which had been published a week earlier in Eugene and Corvallis. As the photographer stepped forward, camera in hand, the deputy ordered him, under the authority of ORS 131.675 sub 2, to arrest the waiting demonstrators or face prosecution for committing a Class C felony. The photographer attempted to carry out the order by walking over to the blockaders and telling them that he was placing them under arrest. They refused to move. The deputy then ordered the photographer to carry the demonstrators to the sheriff's van. At that point, the photographer refused and he was arrested. The deputy then called a second photographer out of the crowd. He was affiliated with the Portland Alliance. He also was ordered to place the blockaders under arrest. After telling the deputy that he was partially disabled because of a back injury, he was placed under arrest as well. Finally, a third man was called from the crowd, was ordered to make the arrest, refused, and was also arrested on the same felony charge. Subsequently, each of the three men was indicted. The ACLU directly represented the two photographers, and we assisted the attorney for the third defendant. In October of last year, the day before a scheduled hearing on the constitutionality of the statute, the district attorney's office moved to dismiss the charges. From the time we first learned of the actions of the Linn County authorities, we were convinced that their actions violated the Oregon and U.S. constitutions. As we began researching the statutes involved, we soon concluded that they were unconstitutional on their face, not merely as they were employed in this case. As far as we've been able to determine, there are no appellate cases directly on point. We are not aware of these statutes having ever been used before. They have existed in Oregon law since at least 1864, where they appear in Deedy's Code. And I've attached a copy at the back of my testimony for your information. They may go as far back as the Oregon Territorial Laws of 1846. It may be of some interest to the committee to compare the present statute to Chapter 39, Sections 444 and 452 of Deedy's Code. Present law grants authority to command persons to assist in arresting those who fail to disperse. It goes on to state that any person who refuses so to do shall be deemed one of the rioters and may be treated accordingly. Although the penalty for violation of this section, spelled out as a Class C felony in 131.990, seems overly harsh to us, consequences for failure to assist in Deedy's time would have been even more severe. Section 452 of the 1864 law states that if any rioters or other persons then present as spectators or otherwise be killed or wounded, the magistrate and officers and persons acting in their aid are guiltless thereof. We suppose that was what was meant by the ominous phrase, may be treated accordingly. You will also note if you examine the concluding phrase of the 1864 statute, that there was a clear double standard. It provides that if any of the magistrates or others acting in their aid be killed or wounded, all the persons engaged in such assembly are guilty thereof. Thus, while the officers had a license to kill, demonstrators could be found guilty by mere association. Thankfully, this portion of the original law was repealed at some point. However, we believe it illuminates the frontier mentality behind the present statute. Under ORS 131.675, Oregonians are either part of the problem or they're part of the solution. We're convinced this statute violates the Oregon Constitution in at least the following ways. In granting unbridled discretion to law enforcement officers in the field to create the criminal jeopardy, it violates the protection against unreasonable search or seizure embodied in Article 1, Section 9. For the same reason, it invites standardless and unequal application of the laws, which is a violation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, Article 1, Section 20. Because there is no definition of unlawful assembly in this statute or anywhere else currently in the RRS, we believe it restrains the right of free assembly, which is protected by Article 1, Section 26. It violates Article 1, Section 34, which prohibits slavery and involuntary servitude other than as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. It also violates Article 1, Section 18, which prohibits the government from demanding the particular services of any man without just compensation. And we believe the penalty violates Article 1, Section 16, which prohibits disproportionate punishment, because a refusal to assist by a public servant is only a Class A misdemeanor, while a refusal by anyone else is a felony. Finally, and I think most importantly, these statutes are unnecessary. ORS 162.245 already makes it a violation to unreasonably refuse to assist a peace officer. Of course, ORS 166.015 prohibits engaging in a riot, which is a felony. As noted earlier, failure to comply with a lawful order to disperse would be a violation of the disorderly conduct statute and is a Class B misdemeanor. We doubt there ever was a need for the type of law such as ORS 131.675. If we ever did need such a riot act, those days are long gone. We urge this committee to repeal this anachronism before it can be used again to create such unconstitutional mischief as we saw last year in Linn County. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Okay. Appreciate that background and that analysis very much. Any questions for Mr. Fedenke? If not, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anyone else on Senate Bill 418? Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Hassel Herring. I'm the editor of the Albany Democrat Herald. I have just a brief statement for you. I'm asking you to approve Senate Bill 418 and thus repeal a section of Oregon law for two reasons. One is that the law is unnecessary. As I understand it, it's been used only once in living memory in Linn County last year. And in that instance, in my opinion, the law was misused. The other reason is that the statute is open to abuse, as I believe the Linn County case illustrated last year. The statute seems to allow otherwise peaceful demonstrators and protesters to be charged with an offense far more serious than their transgression may warrant. I want to mention just two or three other points that I think speak in favor of repeal of this statute. As Dave Fedenke told you a minute ago, there are other statutes that allow police officers to obtain the aid of private citizens to prevent crimes or to make arrests. Moreover, private citizens commanded under this statute may not be physically able, let alone trained, to remove sit-down protesters. You'll notice that the statute in particular exempts from being commanded in this way members of the National Guard, probably the very people, maybe the only people in Oregon who might be trained to deal with riots. But they're the ones who can't be commanded to help. Everybody else can, in the county, anybody. And finally, I worry that in the heat of momentary passion, police may use this law to order news reporters to involve themselves in the news they cover. This is something that conscientious news people try to avoid whenever they can. That's the extent of my statement. I'm glad to have answer any questions if you have any.
Okay. Mr. Herring, it's correct, I understand you were one of the individuals who was involved in this whole series of incidents.
I was not. I was involved only peripherally as the editor of the Albany Democrat Herald, one of the newspapers that covered these events.
Are there any?
I wrote some editorials on the subject, which is one of the reasons I think that maybe you have a bill before you.
Appreciate that. Are there any questions from Mr. Herring? If not, thank you very much, sir, for coming out today. Appreciate your comments. Anyone else on Senate Bill 418? Okay, if not, I want to share with those who are here still and members of the subcommittee that unless there's some problem with these bills, the Senate bills that we've heard, it's my hope to schedule these for a work session on Thursday. So we can, we don't have a lot of Senate bills in committee, but I'd like to move expeditiously on the bills where it's appropriate. And, these bills, I will plan on going ahead and scheduling unless some problem surfaces or we need to conduct further hearing on them. Representative Kopetsky.
I guess on that one bill, if we council could make sure there's sort of a definition of log, which by length.
Definition of a log?
Log. Sort of like a piece of string. You know, how long is a piece of string?
Or trees.
You want to know if there's a definition of a log in the statutes?
Versus a piece of firewood.
Versus a piece of
when
firewood.
When does a piece of firewood become a log?
It goes the other way, doesn't it?
A log. Depends on your chainsaw.
Okay. Anyone else or any other comments on the Senate bills we've had before us? Okay, if not, we'll move to 2711. Mr. Zygar, I notice you're signed up for it. I wasn't sure, sir, if you'd had a chance to appear before us earlier or not on this bill. If not, we'd be more than glad to hear your comments today.
And hear it, what?
Had you testified before on this bill?
Well, yes, I did.
Okay.
We have no objections to it, and being as it's a safety measure, support. Well, we are concerned about just how it could be enforced, but that's not our problem.
Couldn't have said it better myself. I appreciate that comment in terms of enforcement. Was there anyone else? This is listed as a hearing. We did have a prior hearing on this, but if there was anyone else who wished to testify on 2711, in addition to Mr. Zygar's comments, is there anyone at this time? Representative Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 2711 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Miller moves House Bill 2711 to the committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Representative Miller.
Chair, I did have contact with some of the people in my district who were very interested in this bill, and I think they were going to save their comments for the Senate side if the House acts as it did in 1983. And there was a reminder that I think Representative Young probably has an interest, but I guess he's not appearing, and I didn't make an effort to call him, but I'm quite sure he's supported.
Okay. Representative Phillips?
I, too, got some calls from my constituents supporting this measure, saying they were willing to come down and testify if the need be. I somehow didn't feel it. There was an overwhelming need.
Okay. Those who were here last session may recall we had a substantial amount of testimony, both kind of a horror story from a apparently discharge of a firearm within certainly visible distance of a school playground, and we also had, I think, several of Representative Miller's constituents from along the Tualatin River who were concerned about what had become almost family pets were being blasted literally in the front yard of their houses along the river, which is falls outside my definition of sportsmanlike conduct, and also posed a real potential health hazard to those residents. It's true, Representative Miller. I'm sorry, it's true. Representative Miller probably recalls that testimony as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Unfortunate situation, not to make light of it, but I think this bill certainly reflects those concerns, and I know there was quite a bit of discussion in terms of the appropriate yardage, and I think Representative Miller, this 200 yards seems, in light of all the evidence, probably to be the best compromise figure.
This was a product, Mr. Chair, of compromise between those who were anxious to restrict the use and those who certainly want to protect the use of firearms. And as we heard earlier, testimony from Mr. Nichols, he's supportive of this bill. and helped reach the compromise in 1983.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Kopeski.
Is this 200 yards as a pheasant flies, or is it 200 yards on the ground?
Well, Representative Kopeski, I'm going to defer to Representative Miller on that question. Thank you. Representative Miller.
The 200 yards as the discharged shot or bullet flies would be my...
Be your intent.
My intent, yes. I don't think you'd necessarily, at least from the situation I envision on this problem that is nearest and dearest to my heart, is the shot from the boat in the water to the residents abutting the water. I don't think you want to start 200 yards from maybe the time you got to the land at your boat, wherever the nearest dock was or landing, and then start facing 200 yards may not be good. Be the most direct route.
Representative Miller.
Go ahead, Representative.
There's a lake up in Clackamas County. I don't know its real name, but it's, I know its historical name. It's Sucker Creek Lake. Do you know how wide this lake is at its widest point?
What time of year, Representative?
High water mark on the lake, which I think would coincide with duck season.
Representative Kopeski, I appreciate your concern about that lake. However, I really don't know the widest part of that lake. It's probably over 200 yards. I'm quite sure it is.
Representative Kopeski, is this the lake that is also known in the vernacular as Lake Oswego?
I think it is.
Thank you.
I like to use the historical name. We'll be voting on a measure this afternoon to preserve an Oregon historical name. I'm not sure if you're aware, Mr. Chair, but the creek that supplies that lake is Sucker Creek.
Used to be known as Sucker Lake.
And I think some of the residents there...
Chamber of Commerce changed the name.
To the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Kopeski, any further comments?
I think Representative Hill.
Yes, Representative Hill.
To Representative Miller, Mr. Chairman. We had one concern was raised about a dwelling, say, out in the forest. Does this cover, do we define that as not to be a dwelling, or, I mean, so discharging a firearm 200 yards, say, from something that's out in the middle of the woods is, I don't think you have the problem there. I guess it's, is a wooded area considered an unincorporated area?
Yes.
For example, if you're on a, if you own a cabin in the woods and I'm out there hunting, and it's a sparsely populated area, this does, would this prevent me from discharging my weapon within 200 yards of your cabin?
Unless you were the property owner or a guest of the property owner, I believe this law would prohibit the discharge of the firearm within 200 yards of that dwelling. If it's uninhabited, I would suggest your chances of being apprehended under this law are probably slim.
Well, somebody's so well.
However, then maybe that's one of the reasons for the law, I suppose, is that if there is some question about whether or not someone's standing on the porch and you get the animal in the porch in your sights, perhaps you need to be restrained somewhat.
Let me maybe interject at this point. It's my understanding it's against the law at this time to discharge a firearm across any public highway. Now, that doesn't say whether or not the highway is occupied or not, or whether there's a vehicle present, but it does prohibit, as a general matter, firing across a public highway because presumably when a person fires in such a manner, it's really impossible to know. The individual may have a visual inspection, but they may not, and that's perhaps the law errs on the side of overcaution. And I would guess maybe the same reason applies to a dwelling one could try to get at it with occupied dwelling, but then you have a real, maybe an even more difficult problem in terms of how do you determine whether it's occupied or unoccupied, and I guess you come down on the side of caution and you assume that a dwelling, and I think we're referring to a dwelling clearly as a place where it's regular place of habitation, not an outbuilding or a barn, but an actual place of habitation itself.
Well, I have no problems with it. I guess that issue was raised at some point, and I mean, I don't think that the situation of a cabin being located out in the woods is the type of situation that was this bill was designed to cover, and yet some people presumably could be brought in under it. So that I just raised that, and because it, as far as I remember, it hadn't been addressed.
Well, it's a fair question. I think we may want to reflect further or make sure that the record's clear, and also in terms of our intent, and the full committee are on the floor if that question arises.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kopetsky.
I had raised that, I guess, in the initial hearing, and the problem isn't.
Interest in this bill. We had about 2 or 3 weeks ago, at the request of AEA, American Electronics Association, we did introduce a bill, or we gave permission to introduce a bill and to have it prepared through LC, had to do with computer hacking. And members may or may not recall that. We got that to the point that the end of last week, it came back from LC for my signature. And at that point, representatives of AEA, who had originally asked us to introduce the bill, backed off and said, we don't think we need to go ahead with this legislation at this time. And so that bill was not dropped. So though at one time it appeared there might be a vehicle for the computer problem hacking, unless we decide to go ahead and drop that bill, which it's still within our authority to do so, this, it appears, and Mr. Overstreet can correct me if I'm wrong, it appears this bill may be one of the few that relate somewhat to this subject. So I believe that's the reason that Dave approached our committee and council and asked us to consider these amendments. So this is one option. Another option could be to introduce that bill, actually drop it with a chief clerk from AEA, and possibly consider these amendments in that context. So those are the options as I see them at this point, but I, with that introduction, I want to allow Mr. Overstreet to speak to his amendments, which we had asked to be prepared at his request. Dave?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Overstreet. I'm the governmental affairs manager with General Telephone Company of the Northwest here in the state of Oregon. We are this evening proposing amendments to House Bill 2795 specifically to deal with the problem of computer crime or computer hackers, if you will. It's a problem that is on the rise throughout the country, including the state of Oregon. What we are proposing, as you will see from Amendments 2795-3, that we would like to see computer crime become a felony in the state of Oregon. That is the bottom line of this bill. Similar legislation was introduced in the 1983 session as Senate Bill 149, very similar language. Now, I was not here in 1983. I don't know the background on that bill, why that bill did not move. And I also understand that there was some legislation similar to that in 1981. Again, there was no movement on the bill in 1981. The amendments that we're offering would not in any way alter the intent of this bill as it relates to cable TV, as I'm sure you're all aware, based on the approach that we're taking, that is problems as far as computers are concerned, but I just wanted to reiterate that. The research that I've done on this particular bill, this legislation, to this point in time has indicated, and the chairman mentioned this earlier, that there is some support out there. I think there's a lot of support for some type of computer crime legislation in Oregon. I've talked to the Attorney General's office. They have indicated support for this type of legislation. Higher education is interested in this type of legislation. The American electronics industry, as you are now aware, also interested in this type of legislation. I did talk to Pat McCormick today to find out why that bill was withdrawn, and he indicated to me it was simply a time factor on his part, and that was the reason why that was withdrawn. And I think The important thing to recognize is that we are here tonight representing business, not just the telephone industry or General Telephone Company of the Northwest. We're here representing all of business on this measure. I would like to introduce to you right now Sterling Gibson, who is a special agent with our security department out of Everett, Washington, who's been involved with the prosecution of various computer crime cases throughout our serving territory, and he'll discuss the need for this language.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name again is Sterling Gibson. I'm a special agent assigned with our General Telephone Security Office. We're headquartered in Everett, Washington, but I work in five states. Dave, at his invite, come down here to try to explain a little bit of our insights to the computer crime as we have experienced it in actual real-life situations, I guess you'd say, in our contact with the public. We have, through Dave, entered what we call a bill that has been used as a model in other states. It has been adopted in the state of Idaho. I cannot speak for other states that have actually picked up the actual wording. We feel that the House Bill 2795, as it stands, will now encompass the cable TV companies well. However, for other businesses, and most small businesses today are growing to the point where they all have, or if they don't have now, they'll certainly have soon, a computer running their business to some degree. And what we're trying to get into this statute is a part of the law that will prevent people from calling into someone's computer and either manipulating through their intent to manipulate or through inadvertently manipulating the data that's in or stored on that computer system in such a way that it can create all kinds of havoc to that business or industry. And we have mentioned in the House Bill 2795, I see you do have computer services there, which I tend to believe the intent must be to deal with people that sell timeshare. Many colleges today, rather than have their own computer system, buy time from like the Boeing Computer Service Center or perhaps some of your larger ones down here in Oregon. But computer fraud we're talking about is not necessarily computer services for sale, but it's computer service that businesses utilize today. Be that whether it's their own internal network, their own system, or one in which they allow certain vendors with the proper passwords to access. We need some vehicle that will help us control the illegal access of those networks and those systems, which can really devastate a business.
Okay. We'll see if there are any questions on the amendments themselves, if members have had a chance to review them. Let me suggest one just for openers. I note on page 2, right at the bottom, when we speak to the penalty provisions, we speak first of a felony. It's not classified, and I think we need to think about classifying that within our system, as I think you're probably aware we've got A, B, and C felonies. A felony is the maximum, 20 years up to 100,000. B is 10 years up to 100,000. C is 5 years up to 100,000. I would assume you're probably aiming at the threshold felony level, C felony. Is that correct? Okay. And felony, it's undesignated. Generally, any undesignated felony is treated, misdemeanor. The second portion of penalties deals with a misdemeanor. Generally, if it's undesignated, that's interpreted to mean an A misdemeanor. And A misdemeanor is a year in the county jail max and or up to $2,500. I would assume that is your intent, A misdemeanor, which is... When we make that kind of gradation, it usually goes from A misdemeanor to C felony, if that's consistent with what you think ought to be the language there, Mr. Gibson or Mr. Overstreet. Would that?
Well, as far as the actual issuance of penalties and the level of felonies in this state, that's out of my element.
Okay.
So but that sounds reasonable to be parallel to other states.
Okay. I think... apparently, the decision was made to treat more aggravated circumstances as a felony, and I'm assuming C felony, and the lesser or less aggravated circumstances in subsection 4 as a misdemeanor. And I would think to be consistent with the usual statutory scheme, you'd probably want that to be an A misdemeanor. If that is consistent and that seems acceptable to you gentlemen. And we may need to move the language around a little bit to accomplish that, but I think that's the penalty provisions that you have in mind. I'll throw out the same question that I guess I threw out to Mr. Dewey when he was first here, I think, is that under Oregon law, we do have a provision under theft that provides for theft of services, and it could be argued, and we hear this argument whenever a bill is presented to us to make something a crime, that isn't this already covered under law? And some people would suggest to us that theft of services probably already, or tampering, which can be a misdemeanor or can be a felony depending on the gravity and the damage that's involved. Some people would say these things are already crimes if you look at the law and read it carefully. What kind of response would you provide to that?
I almost wish we had a prosecutor up here because I think he'd probably answer that better. In the dealings that I've had with prosecutors on computer crimes and this type of theft, or a lot of times it may not be theft. It may be, it could be construed as theft. However, the actual act was maybe the manipulation or the changing of documents that are vital to that organization's being able to survive, to continue its operation on a day-to-day business basis. That isn't theft. That's manipulation. So how does that wouldn't fit in that category. We're in a state of the art today that wasn't thought of at the time the original theft of services was prevented. Drafted. Certainly, we could probably try to say we have enough existing laws to cover, in the broad sense, these type of things. But when we actually get into the prosecution of a crime of this nature, we find that they're too broad and they're not usable. At least that's the experience that I've had in the past. And again, we're not dealing necessarily with the theft of something, maybe the manipulation. We have in the environment of computers the availability of information being observed by another competitor, which could also be a critical thing. He's not stealing the information, but it gives him the standpoint of having a better position to be in if it was coming to bid for a contract item. So I would answer it that way. Again, I'm out of my element. A prosecutor would be best to answer that.
Okay.
Just by way of information, Dick, I talked with our legal counsel in Everett this morning, and they reviewed 164.125 to 164.130, and it was their opinion that this would dovetail with what is in the law, but would specifically address the problem that, of course, that we're trying to solve the problem with, and it's their belief that there is very little overlap, if any.
Okay. Well, if there's affirmative action on this amendment, we'll leave it to legislative counsel to decide where in the criminal statutes this ought to go. I would guess it's going to go pretty close to the theft sections, and there may be an additional section that they put in as part of their drafting which says that this new language is added to and made a part of ORS, whatever it's going to be. But I think we've got the penalty section sorted out, and we can, I guess, at this point, open it up to questions and a motion, if a motion is within the desire of the committee on this draft. Representative Kopetsky.
I guess I have a question. I don't know much about this computer stuff, but it seems to me that, or I guess I heard that you can buy some sort of a software system that, and I don't know even the terminology, where you buy into different programs and you do this over the telephone and you got your computer and it's hooked up to the telephone system and push some buttons and it kind of scans for certain programs. Mr. Gibson, do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I'm getting a vague drift of what you're saying. It almost sounds like rather than you purchasing all the software needed to software, if you can read the definition here, enables you to compile the data the way you want to, or the information the way to store it the way you want to. Well, rather than have to go out and purchase all these expensive software packages, perhaps you have a number that you can dial up with your computer. Now you're using communication links strictly to get from point A to point B.
Right.
Now you get into this business that's selling you that service, software programming. and you're able to compile your information or store your data in the format you want to on their system. That sounds like what you're talking about, and that's referred to in the past as a timeshare type availability to any subscriber who wants to purchase that service from them. But your data is being stored in the format, or your information is being stored in the format you want it to be stored at, both at their computer, and you also probably have the capability to download that back into your own system. That's a term used to bring it back into storage on your own facility, in the format you put it into using their equipment.
Are you also able to, they've got information stored in their computer, and you're calling it up, and you're able to utilize theirs?
Yeah, this,
their information.
This is the type of case that you probably heard something about a few years back when the kids at the Upper State New York School got into some very sophisticated computer systems up into Canada. And what they were doing was they were using the telecommunication network strictly as a transmission medium to get from point A to B. When they got to point B up in Canada, they then went into the various files of these businesses up there, inadvertently changing some of the information, which, had they not been aware of the access attempts being occurring, would not have been able to take the protective measures to prevent them from perhaps even going out of business, because they said the information they were changing or trying to access and inadvertently changing could have caused them several million dollars in costs.
Well, it's my understanding that sometimes you can, when they scan for these systems, that you may get the wrong system, or you may not have paid for a certain system or something like that.
In the world of the computer hacker today, they use the word scanning for several things, but I think from what you're saying here, what we've found, you know, what is the Star Wars scenario is, when a, and I'll use a youth because that's the environment we're usually dealing with, but it doesn't have to always be. But when he is ready to go to school that day, he will set his program on his home computer up to do what he calls exchange scanning. So he can set up any prefix he wants, meaning any, I don't know what your dialing numbers are, say 391. And then if he looks in his phone book, he sees maybe the 2000 series numbers being used. He sees 2492 and maybe 2584 or whatever. So he'll set his computer up to exchange scan all day long while he's at class, and he'll set it up to scan the 2000 series. So when he leaves in the morning, he'll start it with a run, and that thing will sit there all day while he's at school, and it will dial the same prefix number and then 2001. And it's programmed to look for the tone back, which most computer centers today utilize to indicate they've accessed a computer line or a data link. And then after that call is completed, it will dial another one, 2002. 2003. All day long, it'll do that while he's at school. He comes home from school, and he puts print list, and if he's got the software in there for scanning, it'll print every number that gave the tone back. Now what he'll do is then he'll start calling those, he'll look the numbers up, find out what they belong to, or call information. Or he'll just dial them, and he'll see if he gets a tone, then he'll determine whether he can break the password, or whether he just inadvertently got a wrong number and hit a busy back tone or whatever it was. But that's how they do exchange scanning, to find out what computers are even out there. Then their interest develops now. Can I get into this thing? Can I look around? And he tries passwords all day. And he'll do the same thing with passwords. He'll set that same number up. And he'll leave in the morning, and he'll try passwords all day long on that same system. And so we see a lot of that happen.
Representative Kopetsky, if you've seen the movie War Games last night on cable TV.
Was that again last night? Every time they put that on, we have, I've had several businesses, like I said, the one in Oregon, an engineering firm down in Portland called me, this had to be several months ago, said, we have a computer system here that we know is being illegally accessed, or it's being attempted to at night. People have tried to come in here. My first question is, are you dial access? Which means, can anybody have that dialing number? That's correct. And you give a tone back, and then he has to give a password. Well, yeah, that's right. And then he can look at what? Your bulletin board and so on and so forth. Well, any business today that has a computer system that's dial accessible is vulnerable to what we call the hackers today. And they're a very prolific group, and they're busy. They're not heard of a lot. They're getting a lot more publicity as time goes on, but they're very busy out there.
I guess I got a constituent in Northeast Sale that, you know, legit. You know, he doesn't play around, but he's got all these things. And I told him about this bill, and I said, well, just make sure that, you know, I can't be nailed on this for unintentionally, you know, doing things. I mean, he's not, he buys these things, that, you know, these packages or whatever, buys into these things. And, I mean, you're not going to be able to go after those guys, right?
If he's a legitimate user, he'll have what they call a billing code. Your amendments here to this first revision on 2795 bring into what we call the ICs, or I think you used to call them OCCs, your inter-exchange carriers, not the Bell system and not the general telephone, as we know telephone companies, but your SaveNets, your Sprints, your MCIs. They'll now be covered because you've got available for compensation telephone service. They weren't protected in the past. And so what we found is kids put up on the bulletin boards codes. And what they'll do is for an MCI or a Sprint or a SaveNet or an AllNet, they'll post a 6-digit billing code and a local access number to dial. So if Sprint is being offered here in Salem, the subscribers that subscribe to Sprint will all get the telephone number to call here in Salem to access a Sprint. Then they have to put in their 6-digit billing code, or 7 or 5 or whatever they're using. That specifically tells Sprint that call is made by yourself and will bill to you. But those codes get out, or the kids will use their computers and try codes all day until they get dial tone. And then they'll put that up on the bulletin board. Here's a local access number, and here's a valid code that's being used. And those things we found in the hackers we had arrested up in Seattle, not using a computer crime law, but using fraud and obtained telephone service because they were using a blue box capability of a computer. What they were doing was they would put on 3 bulletin boards in the greater Seattle area codes if they wanted to just give them out. And they told me in 30 minutes those codes could be used in 48 states. That's how intense that information gets across country.
But let's go back to my friend in Northeast Salem.
He'll have a valid billing code.
It's not for a telephone. No.
May I ask a couple questions here?
Okay.
And I'm sorry if I missed this when I stepped out for a moment. Is this language taken from any other states, or did we just kind of
crunch
this?
This was a model bill that was used across the country in various states. It is identical to the wording that Idaho adopted this copy of the bill. Because I'm not into this business that much, wouldn't be able to tell you what other states have adopted this same language, but I know it was a model bill. We know that.
Okay. Next question I have is, we're talking about not just interstate communications. I mean, I understand these things can happen in the state, but isn't there a federal legislation or federal law that deals with this problem? And I realize in federal enforcement and getting the FBI to investigate anything is a big problem, but to what extent does federal law govern this area as opposed to state law?
Again, I'm out of my element here because I've been away from this a little bit, but as long ago as 1979, the first introduction of computer crime, they tried the Ribicoff bill. That was bouncing around for 2 years in 1979 or 80. To my knowledge, there's been no federal statute passed. And Honeywell Information Systems down in Arizona was the leader in computer crime lobbying to try and get a law in back in the late 70s. Finally, they gave up on the federal bill ever getting passed, and they enacted their own state law. And then California followed suit after them. But I'm not aware of a federal statute that involves computer crime at this time, and they don't have one that I know of.
Okay. Dave, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just going to indicate that if, in fact, federal legislation has been passed, it does not affect the private sector in any way, shape, or form. I referenced in my communications to Leslie on this bill that perhaps there was a bill passed at the national level within the last few years, and I don't recall the number on it. It was passed by the House of Representatives at the national level, but again, it does not affect the private sector in any way.
Okay. Are there any further questions for Mr. Overstreet or for Mr. Gibson? Why don't I go ahead and accept a motion, and then we'll see if Representative Kopetsky had any further questions.
No questions.
Rep. St. Phillips.
I'd like to move the adoptions of the amendments proposed by Mr. Overstreet, HB 2795-3, to House Bill 2795.
Okay, and Rep. St. Phillips, would that include the amendments to Section 5 on page 2 that would designate the felony as a C felony and the misdemeanor as an A misdemeanor?
That's correct.
Okay.
Recognizing that council might have to make some sort of changes to that to make the wording fit.
Understood. And the council will also be given the discretion to, if necessary, provide an additional section to designate where this should go in ORS.
Yep.
Okay. Rep. St. Phillips so moves. For the discussion, Rep. St. Kopetsky.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if in lines 7, 15, and 20, we could insert after the word knowingly, and with evil intent. Or, no, let's see. And with...
with males support that.
Well, it's getting closer.
Rep. St. Kopetsky, I think you want to move from the definition section over to section 2 or 3 or 4 if you want to deal with the mens rea or culpable mental state.
There we go.
We do have knowingly and without authorization, and knowingly and without authorization. I suppose we could state, and Mr. Penn is here to advise us further, I suppose we could state knowingly and intentionally. That would make you feel better. Mr. Penn is going to respond, however.
Knowingly is included within the element of intentional.
Okay.
And I would encourage the committee not to use evil intent. I don't know what that means.
Okay, Mr. Penn, I don't know if you've met all the people at the table. Now, Mr. Penn is our district attorney from Marion County. And he's been very helpful to us, and we value his advice on these kinds of issues. Rep. St. Kopetsky, did you want to make a further suggestion?
Well, now that I got my DA here. It's because he's going to have to try to prosecute one of these things, except for mine.
I'm sure he's going to listen very carefully to your comments
in
terms of the intent as it relates to your constituent from Northeast Salem.
Who's that constituent?
No, he really is legit, and he's not a kid. He's not a kid. It's this, it's great. 50-year-old man, and he's just having the time of his life.
Is his name Copenhagen?
No.
Sorry. Representative Capacity.
Well, I guess, can I ask Mr. Penn a question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Dale, can you try to respond here?
Dale, I guess.
You can include this in the bill.
Okay. Are you satisfied with this language, knowingly and without authorization? Because, now they are authorized a lot of times to somehow they have these scanning devices that they can go by, pass by or whatever. They can actually see the program or the catalog and what's in this catalog that's there, and then, but if they haven't paid for that, they're not supposed to go in and do it, but they still see it.
Well, okay, there we get into definition of access, I think. If you call up a bulletin board, okay, the UN.
I'm sorry.
If you call up to a computer system.
Yeah.
And you're not authorized to, you're probably not even going to be able to get the menu up. If you're calling to a bulletin board, you're going to see the menu. And that's not what we're addressing here. We're addressing a computer system in which you're not authorized to dial. You won't know the codes. You may get his number. Then you start playing with it to find out what's in there. You're not going to get that by dialing up the number. You can't inadvertently dial a number and just get that. You'll get a bulletin board or something to that effect. But if you're dialing into these systems that we're talking about here, i.e. some small business that has a computer system, if they're allowing you to dial it up and see everything that's in there without even putting in any access code, then I would strongly consider they may want to review what they're doing and maybe unplug that thing at night.
Yeah,
I mean, that's almost like leaving the door wide open with all the money laying on the floor.
Dale, if these guys bring any complaints, if there are any people in District 33, would you check with me? All right.
Certainly. I might only add that
this language here, knowingly accesses, I have to prove that this person, to be guilty of this crime, had the design to not only access and attempt to access or use, but for the purpose of defrauding, fraudulent misrepresentations, or committing theft. And those would be the key elements. If I can't prove that, then the crime doesn't lie.
Okay.
Is that helpful?
Yes. Just glad all that's on the record.
Thank you. That's an important statement of intent, I think, and
yeah.
Necessary and appropriate. Are there any further questions, comment, or discussion? Are there any objections to Representative Phillips' motion on the amendments LC-3? If not, they're adopted. Motion on the bill is amended. Representative Kapetsky?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2795 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the full committee.
Thank you. Representative Kapetsky moves House Bill 2795 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Hill.
Aye.
Kapetsky.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Phillips.
Here. Aye. Let's stay with you.
Aye. Motion's adopted. Let's deal with the fireworks issue next.
Representative Bellamy gets to see the
governor.
Yes. Yeah, you get to see
Vic.
Do you
want to
know?
Yeah.
Okay. Counsel, could you give us some background, please, on the fireworks bill as it's now before us?
All right. The first thing you ought to know is that you should have in front of you a hand-engrossed copy marked hand-engrossed by John McCulley, 5285. Do you? Let me check with that. Yes, it looks like you do. These are the amendments as drafted by Legislative Council that reflect some discussions by the various parties involved in this particular bill. And these are all hand engrossed amendments that I suggest that we would like to discuss this evening. I will say this about the amendments. They were mailed to the state fire marshal, who has seen them, I believe, and has indicated that they meet his need. They've also been mailed to Zach Lortz, who is the attorney, and he's present, who represents Cascade Fireworks,